Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 2 for Autumn Semester 2013. Lecture 6, delivered on September 9, 2013. The title of this lecture is Financial Institutions.
Today, Financial Institutions. This will be a relatively brief lecture because I'm just cleaning up Chapter 3 here, and I don't want to start into Chapter 4 until until Wednesday, simply because Chapter 4 is the chapter on accounting. And I put that off as long as I can, but eventually I have to teach some accounting here, remind you of accounting and all that kind of good stuff. But for today, this is the cleanup of financial institutions. I'm going to put up some articles. I didn't get it done. I don't think I got it done. Several articles, two of which I wrote, The Federal Reserve Under Fire, Parts 1 and 2. The links are right there on isu-prof.com in the left sidebar if you want to get started on them. But otherwise, I'll put the links on ReggieNet tonight. I'm also going to have you read several articles by financial investigative reporter Matt Taibbi, essentially laying out some of the issues involved in the current policy called Too Big to Fail. As I have mentioned before, right now the financial institutions of the United States, the largest ones, are under the protection of the United States government, specifically the Federal Reserve, with the idea that these banks must be kept alive despite their wrongdoing, despite their bad financial management decisions, and despite the problems that they're creating in the domestic and global financial markets, simply because we can't let them fail, because if they failed, the consequences would be absolutely catastrophic to the global financial system. Whether or not this policy will continue, right now it is the rule. And that means that to the tune of some $14 trillion, the United States government, that is the taxpayers eventually, are keeping these banks alive. And they have been since 2007. But you'll read about the too big to fail philosophy, what its consequences are in those articles. But suffice it to say that right now, one reason we have this policy is that the United States government has become intimately connected financially with these extraordinarily large financial institutions. Essentially, these financial institutions of this giant scale are the asset managers for the United States government. It's sort of like outsourcing on an incredibly large and crucial scale. I want to bring up something here, and I've brought this one up before, the Glass-Steagall Act. This was passed in the 1930s because of the excesses and the disasters that had come about, excuse me, because of an unregulated or poorly regulated, loosely regulated financial institutions environment that had been the rule in the United States for many, many decades. In fact, the banking system was so poor, had such a poor reputation from its inception, that some of our founding fathers wrote scathing damnation of banking in general and some banks in particular. By the time we get to the 1930s, the consequences of this lack of regulation of the banks had caused substantial economic problems and had exacerbated what was a recession and helped to turn it, with several other bad decisions, into the Great Depression. Glass-Steagall was passed, And among the many provisions, and I'll bring this up again in at several points in this course, was that a wall was created between the banking activities of a bank and investment activities of a bank. We called it the Chinese Wall because it was like the Great Wall of China. A wall so that the investment decisions that a bank made could not impact its day-to-day operations in ensuring the safety of depositors' money. That was a big, big part of Glass-Steagall, was making sure that banks could not have a conflict of interest in their operations. So I couldn't, on the one hand, be taking your money as deposits, but on the other hand, also the same person who was talking you into putting your money in a safe place, I couldn't also be deciding where I was going to invest that money in some unsafe business practice or some risky investment. In 1999, Glass-Steagall was ended as a new era came about. By the way, there will be an article on that, how that happened. And the plan that was in place for why the, for lack of a better term, the neoliberal era needed the Glass-Steagall Act removed to complete a globalization of our financial system. Now, in that time period of the 1990s, you had two very strong forces both influencing the United States government. And they've both carried forward to this day. There was the neoconservative aspect of the government's policymaking, which included projecting force throughout the world and reestablishing the American empire for the 21st century. The neoliberal component was something else. It was designed to reinvigorate industrial policy and to reestablish, or rather to construct, a financial system that was efficient, innovative, and ready for the 21st century. Both of these were in play starting in the 1990s, and they both moved through the 21st century. Glass-Steagall ending in 1999 allowed for the production of such things as international globalization of manufacturing on a very large scale. It also was the means, one of the points by getting rid of Glass-Steagall, you saw the explosion of the derivatives market through the first decade of the 21st century. You saw innovative instruments, highly risky instruments, and a lack of wall between investment activities of banks and the actual responsible management of depositors' money. The consequences of that have been pretty much disastrous. There have been calls to renew Glass-Steagall. They're not going to happen. It just ain't going to happen. Even though it would be great to go back, we just can't turn around from where we are now. The system has become so integrated the way it is that we can't fix it. And the efforts to reform the system after the crisis of 2008, the financial crisis of 2008, those have pretty much fallen by the wayside now. No meaningful reform ever came about. However, what we have now is something called Dodd-Frank. This is a piece of legislation that places extraordinary reporting requirements on financial institutions. It also places specifics about what are the target ratios for financial institutions in terms of certain types of capital that they have and all of that. The effect of Dodd-Frank has been to actually drive the financial system towards fewer and larger institutions, simply because the burdens of reporting and the ability to hit these targets, some of which don't make sense to anyone, just makes it so that smaller financial institutions really struggle under this pressure. As one of the asset managers, wealth managers, at a local growing division of a bigger company mentioned in a speech last year to my finance students, she would like to take the people who wrote Frank Dodd and quote-unquote punch them in the nose. And this is a very polite lady, and I never thought I'd hear her say that, although I'd love to see it happen. I'd YouTube that bitch in a minute. But Dodd-Frank, and I'll speak a little more about Dodd-Frank and this industrial policy of too big to fail here in a few minutes. Now, in the textbook chapter 3, they bring up just how complex our regulatory system of banks is. Some types of banks are overseen by the Federal Reserve. Some types of banks are overseen by the FDIC, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. Some banks are overseen by state regulators. Some banks are overseen by other entities. And then there are other financial institutions that act like banks, but they aren't banks. Like, for example, credit unions. Then there are these old animals that got into trouble in a financial fiasco in the 1980s called savings and loans, and related institutions called building and loans. And then there are all kinds of other animals. Every one of them has its own regulatory agency overseeing it. There is no overall overseer of all financial institutions. Each of these agencies has its own turf, and they ain't going to give it up. There was a little bit of an effort after the financial crisis in 2008 to get a one regulator of all financial institutions. And that didn't work out too well. Interestingly, part of it was because of the turf thing. FDIC said, we're not going to give up our authority over our banks. The state said, you can go to hell. It was the federal banks that were all collapsing. Ours were doing fine. And then, of course, you had the Federal Reserve saying, we should be overseeing all banks. And there were a lot of people in Congress saying, you, the Federal Reserve, really? After your dynamic performance in 2000, from 2001 till 2008, you think you should be in charge of them? No, you shouldn't. So it never came to anything. So there's still this massively fractionalized system. Now, as far as banks go, let me just talk about banks here. Different banks have different kinds of charters. Let me put it that way. Now, some banks are chartered by the federal government. In other words, they are authorized to be banks by some federal agency. Commercial banks, a lot of the ones that you would know about are like that. But they aren't the only ones. Like I said, there are state banks, banks that are chartered by states. They are overseen by state regulators, and they tend to do okay. And then there are these ones like, for example, community banks. Now, community banks tend to be smaller, and their charters are specifically to the effect that they don't do global and national investments. They are more towards investing in the communities in which they are run. So a community bank would take in depositors' monies, probably just from a community, or it would have some branches in that community and maybe in the county. And then what it would do is when it had all this money to lend out, it would lend for local projects, local needs, people in the community, businesses in the community, the government of that community. That bank would be dedicated to using most of its capital to do that kind of work. Community banks. There is an old variation on this animal called a mutual bank. They were around for years and years, and there are still a few of them around, but they proved to be a highly successful model for banking, even though you don't see them very much. Now, a mutual bank was like a community bank, but its depositors were actually owners of the bank. So if you wanted to start a checking account at a mutual bank, you were essentially becoming an owner of that bank. You might even be held to, they check your references. They make sure that you were a decent kind of person in some cases, and they did not want riffraff as the owners of their banks, of their bank. Now, here's the interesting part about that. As if you are the depositors of a mutual bank, you're the owners of that mutual bank. You probably know a lot of the other owners because you're all in the same town. That mutual bank is like a community bank. It's a localized bank. And what that means also is that when the president of the bank or the chief financial officer of the bank walks down the street, you know him. And you can also, because you know him, he'll be sitting at the diner. You can walk up to him. If they've been screwing up, you can walk up to him and say, just what the hell did you do with our money? There was this direct face-to-face accountability in those kinds of banks. They were highly successful. They were, in fact, so successful that in many ways, those small banks like that rode out the great banking collapse that happened with the Great Depression. They did fine. They were not the ones that fell apart. It was the big Wall Street banks that came crashing down. In fact, it was the case in one horrible incident that a very successful set of financial institutions that were in black communities in a large city in Kansas did so well that the white people burned down all the banks and killed a whole bunch of people because it pissed them off because these people who ran these banks had done so properly to shield themselves from the disasters of economic crisis. So there you are. Mutual banks were a great model because there was the ownership, was the depositors were the owners. And they could hold people accountable at the officer and executive level of the bank because everyone lived in the same community. And you really, if you're going to do dirt, you really don't want to do it in a community where you have to live and where your kids go to school and where you go to church. It worked pretty well. It's not around now, though. There's a whole garden variety of those kinds of animals, but let me get on to another kind of financial institution that's very popular now. It's the credit union. Know this, a credit union is not a bank. A credit union is not a bank. And as I mentioned before, when you put money into a checking account at a bank, you are putting your money into what is called a demand deposit. On demand, the bank has to surrender the money to the bearer of an instrument. So if I have a check that you have written to me, then I am the bearer of an instrument. I can go to your bank and with proper credentials, I can say on the spot, I demand this money. You can go to an ATM, and if you got the money in there and the credentials, you can say, I demand my money, and it has to be yielded to you immediately. Demand deposit. That's a bank. A credit union does not offer demand deposit, a demand account. It looks like a demand account. There are these things that look like checks, but it is not a demand account. It is called a negotiable order of withdrawal instrument. And it's not a, the bearer instruments are not checks. That's the bearer instrument on a bank. In a credit union, you will probably see the word spelled like that, which is a written evidence that it ain't the same. So if you have a credit union account and you wrote me a check on that, I'll go to the credit union and I'll say, I demand this money. Now, they'll probably take care of it right there. That's usually what they do. But they don't legally have to. They can say, you wait, Sparky. You sit back and hold on. A couple of days, 10 days, 30 days, you have to wait. So, like I said, in most normal circumstances, it's just the same. No credit union is going to be stupid and try to pull that too often. But they don't have to. In other words, there is a slight degradation of liquidity between a bank's demand deposits and a credit union's negotiable order of withdrawal deposits. You follow it? It's just a slight, slight degradation of liquidity. Will you ever notice it? Probably not. Now, here's the thing about credit unions. First of all, a credit union exists around a common bond policy. In other words, there has to be something about the depositors that is the same. That narrows the risk. So, in other words, you'll have a credit union here at ISU, the ISU Credit Union. That is for Illinois State University students and employees. You will have credit unions at many companies have their own credit union these days. The common bond being you're all employees of this company. There are credit unions that are for government workers, the common bond of government workers. A problem there is that a lot of these credit unions, those rules have been loosened so much that credit unions are basically taking anyone and everyone these days. You're also seeing marriages or partnerships between credit unions that might be a little bit concerning. So, for example, the ISU credit union considers as its quote-unquote sister credit union one called Prairie Land out here. Now, where the common bond is between those? Well, they both have people in this community, but you have two separate common bonds working together, common bond structures that are now in sort of like a partnership of some kind, a contractual partnership. Now, here's the thing about credit unions. If you join a credit union and you are approved, you become an owner of the credit union. Sound familiar? It's like a mutual bank. One of its strengths, ownership by the actual depositors. That's important to remember. Interestingly about that, though, and honest to God, I know mutual banks from the old days. Never saw it there, but it's just like automatic policy. When I joined the credit union, the ISU credit union, one of the things I signed was an agreement that I would give my votes, my vote, my share of vote on officers and directors and policymakers, my shareholder vote, I gave that to someone else, to one of their people. And that's called a proxy. They're very common in corporations. You sign a proxy giving some controlling management interest your votes for the shareholder meeting. Very common. I was actually a little surprised when I found out that the credit union sort of stuck it in my face, said, here, sign this. Legally, I'm pretty sure I didn't have to sign it, but, you know, I was just sitting there, you know, I need to get out of here because it's lunchtime. So they try to slip this thing to you so that you really, even though you're a shareholder, you're handing your voting power over to someone you don't know. Yeah, one way or the other. Banks hate credit unions. They hate them with a passion. They say that the credit unions are destroying banks because credit unions have one nice little feature that banks don't. Credit unions don't pay federal taxes. They're tax exempt. You can imagine how that pisses off the banks. The idea there being that there has been a public policy to foster the credit unions, to let them proliferate. Partly, the idea was to offer an alternative to the traditional commercial bank. That was a lot of what it was all about, was we should allow for kinds of financial institutions that aren't just banks. And credit unions fill that gap very nicely. But let me take you on an interesting point about credit unions. Now, you would deal in your lives typically with just a credit union. It's just a generic, and they're actually pretty nice, a good alternative to your typical bank. However, there are banks for banks. Remember I told you the Fed was a bank for bank, as are some commercial institutions. There are banks for banks that are private, and they compete with the Fed for banks business. Well, credit unions have the same deal. Credit unions have sort of like an overseeing federal agency. They can use that for their banking purposes, but there are also credit unions for credit unions. They're called federal credit unions. Federal credit unions. They are the credit unions for credit unions. Now, I won't mention the name of this credit union, federal credit union, but I took my finance students up to Chicago, and the first place we went was to a federal credit union. The CEO and several top executives spoke to my students. Now, it's one of those things where, oh, God, why would we want to go to a federal credit union? Roll the eyes. Well, for one thing, it's a great place if you are into financial institutions and you don't want to work for the evil empire of Bank of America. There you go. A federal credit union is a credit union for credit unions. They are massive, extraordinarily powerful institutions. The one up that I took my students to in suburban Chicago was one of the 10 largest in the nation. Speakers came in one after the other talking about, well, here's what credit unions do, here's what federal credit unions do, and they did a really nice job of explaining some of the details of the liquidity crisis and the credit crisis of 2008. It was really great. You had some real high-powered, top-of-the-line analysts came in to explain the background of finance in the United States and the globalization of finance and the Federal Reserve and all that. And I was out in the hallway just kind of milling around looking for free food. They hadn't brought in the catering yet. But the president of the Federal Credit Union came out from his little speech, and I heard the applause. And he came walking by me, and I just thanked him as a courtesy. I really appreciate you coming and talking to my students because they really don't know about credit unions, and especially the concept of a federal credit union, when you're one of the big 10, so I greatly appreciate you hosting us today. And he was extraordinarily glib. He said, well, we'll be gone within 2 years. This particular one had gone belly up, went into receivership, and had come back from the dead, from the crisis, financial crisis. They were strong. They had come back. And I could, why? I thought, God, am I going to hear insider information? He said, I said, is this something I shouldn't hear? And he said, oh, no. He said, the government is just driving us out. We're going to be forced to be merged into one of the bigger ones than us. I said, one of the top five? He said, no, one of the top two. He said, the policy is to just keep putting the pressure on with regulations and other lack of assistance financially so that we eventually have to buckle and be swallowed up by one of the bigger ones above us. So ultimately, there again, going back to the first part of my lecture, this industrial policy where we are seeing larger and larger institutions at the expense of the wider diversity of ecology in the financial markets of many, many institutions. And so I asked him, I said, well, what is your take on why they're doing this? And he said, it's twofold. One of them, he said, was the one that I had always said, well, they want these financial institutions to be big enough that they can be part of the government's financial structure. And the other reason, he said, is the old policy, which was in place from the Kennedy era, instead of having many, many companies in an industry to regulate, which is extraordinarily difficult. You force consolidation of the industry to only a very few companies, and then that is easier to regulate. Instead of regulating 50,000 cats, you just regulate three or four saber-toothed tigers, basically. And that's what he said. And so if I don't know how right he is, but that's kind of, it's just the old, that's the old industrial policy we had back in the 1960s. So there you go. That's where we are now. Okay. Enough of that. Okay. I went through the banks, the credit unions, and I don't want to say anything negative. Credit unions are actually a great alternative to the traditional bank. And they have their own overseeing regulatory agency that keeps a good watch on them, although, like I said, the one thing that they're slipping on is the common bond principle. A lot of these credit unions, they'll say anyone can join now. Okay, now, as far as other financial institutions go, let me just bring up a couple that are out there that provide financial intermediation services of one kind or another. Among them, this sort of like this garden variety that would be other financial intermediaries would be, for example, pension funds. Okay, I'm going to break something off here, but it's part of a larger thing. Insurance companies, which is actually part of something larger, cash flush corporations. In other words, there are many corporations out there that have a lot of money. They have tons of money, and they have to do something with that money. So they essentially can serve in one way or another as a matcher of their funds that are available with needs that are in the financial market. In other words, they can be a surplus economic unit, and then they can serve as the intermediary to match their surplus money with that of deficit economic units. So, for example, you could have something like a pension fund, an insurance company, or a large corporation that could be a significant buyer of a bond issue for a new school or for a water, sewerage and water project, or something like that. These, in other words, they're both surplus units, but they can also be their own financial intermediaries in some cases. In other cases, they'll let brokerage houses handle their money to do this. But in some cases, they're right there. They'll provide the funds for a big project. And with an insurance company, that's a lot of money. I mean, it's a huge amount of money they've got because... did I tell you that someday you're going to die? Okay. Well, you are. Okay? But not today, probably. So we're going to have to do something with the money that you're putting into your insurance pot. You do have insurance, don't you? Okay. Well, I mean, until you die, that money's just going to sit there. Okay? So we got to do something with it. That money could be part of a funding a school, or a bridge, or a water project, or a new road. Okay, gotta do something with it. You know, we'll pay off when you die eventually, you know. But, okay, other things that are like this, annuities. Dead people sometimes leave a lot of money. And that money goes somewhere. In that case, so for example, ISU got a really nice $5 million commitment from something that's someone that died. I don't know how it worked. But, okay, we've got $5 million. Okay, what would you do with $5 million?
I have no idea. Get a house.
A house? That's not going to, that's a hell of a house. I would spend every bit of that, mofo. You know, I would use it. But we got to be responsible in the university. We've got to have that money in some way so that it returns to us slowly, at a trickle, to fund a professor chair or to fund a center for research or for student services, something like that. So what happens is we want to lend that money out and then to see that money come back as an annuity through time. So we can be an intermediary saying, okay, you guarantee us 4% on this money every year. We'll put that $5 million into your project, and then that means that we get 4% back every year for the next 30 years, and then we get our $5 million back at the end. That could be one place where another type of financial institution or a financial intermediary in some way. And then there's other oddballs out there too. But all of these kind of come together in one way or another to provide money where it's needed in one way or another. There was a fellow who spoke to my finance students last year. He is one of the people who sets up the funding for local projects, for school bond issues, for, like I said, water and sewerage projects, for convention centers and all that kind of stuff. He sets up the financing for the communities, school districts, and all that. And he explained, interestingly enough, he really didn't talk too much about banks and stuff like that. He talked about things like this as where he goes to deal with how we fund this. We need a new high school. Okay, well, we're going to work out the details. I know these are how these people want the details so that they'll finance it. Once he's got the side that needs the money all set up with how they're going to fund, what they're going to do with the money, how they're going to pay it back, then he goes to these places and says, okay, we've got a $7.6 million school bond issue, and we're going to need the money for that. Will you commit at this percentage rate? And then he negotiates with these people on how much the rate is, and they fund it. Now, if I could do that kind of stuff, that'd be great. But, you know, this is how it works. So in some ways, and I can't say this is wildly true, but in some ways, the traditional banking system, because there are so many questions and issues about it, there are these alternatives that are showing up now that are kind of like a way around it. So, for example, with very large corporations, if you are an employee of that corporation at a certain point, you might be able to get your home loan through the company. It would set it up through some bank that it had or some credit union, but that money is not coming through the traditional financial system. It's coming through the cash that corporation generates, and then it invests it back into the employees of that corporation for their life needs. So there are these alternatives that are coming up out there, and in your lives, you might find that a bank is going to be something you hear about, but it isn't going to be what you use for your life's needs and for in terms of money that you need and money that you have to make available to others that need it. Credit union, you might work for a corporation that uses one of these kinds of mechanisms to fund projects because it's got money. It funds projects through these. So the world is on two tracks. One is these giants that are so large that we cannot dare let them fail. We can't even regulate them without making them mad at us. Those are one side. And then this variety that's kind of coming up on its own that's on the other side. That's all I have for you. Go home.